Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by Rob Burley, editor of The Andrew Marr Show. As well as working on Marr, Rob is currently editor of BBC Newswatch and deputy editor of All Live Political Output. Starting his career working for Labour MP Paul Flynn, he later joined ITV and worked his way up the ranks, ending up editing their flagship political shows, The Sunday Edition and The Jonathan Dimbleby Programme. He moved to the BBC in 2008, going on to become executive editor of Question Time and then deputy editor of Newsnight. Rob, thanks for joining me.
Hi.
So, Rob, you first started your career working in politics for Paul Flynn. Did you always think you'd work at Parliament, that you'd be in politics? Was that your first career choice?
Yeah, I think I was fascinated by politics growing up in the 80s, which ages me. But yeah, I was fascinated by it and was desperate to kind of, once I'd left university, to kind of to see what it was about and experience it. And I think I actually wrote to members of Parliament across the parties just to try and get in there.
So how many letters?
A lot of letters, a mail shot, you know, a lot of letters. And eventually through, I can't really remember the exact chronology, I ended up working with Paul, who was a kind of a Labour MP from Wales, from Newport.
He wrote the book How to Be an MP, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
I love that book. When I was an aspiring MP for many sad years, I read that book. I love that book.
In terms of understanding the work of a constituency MP, you know, it's a great book. And working with him, it really showed you the work they do. They do work very hard. The conscientious ones, the ones who are in it for their issues and in it for their constituents. And so I don't think I really enjoyed Parliament that much, actually. I didn't really enjoy the trappings of it all and the kind of the procedural stuff and the pomp and ceremony of Parliament and the committees and all that.
Sergeant at Arms and the banqueting committee and Black Rod and all that kind of stuff.
That turned me off, I think. Whereas I think a lot of people love that. They kind of get into that. And there are people in political programmes, obviously a lot of people who are very kind of interested in that side of it. And and it's great that there are. But I didn't think it was right for me once I was there. I didn't think this is where I want to stay. And certainly not any kind of teenage thoughts of being a politician quickly disappeared at that
because
point.
You realised the reality of it was a bit crap.
You don't really know. This is the thing. I mean, people think when they talk about their careers that there's a plan. There's usually not a plan. There's usually a series of bits of trial and error. And even if you don't quite know what it is you want to do, you don't really respond necessarily particularly well to, you know, a particular job or environment. And I think that was it. I mean, I enjoyed working with him. He's a great man. I loved him. He was excellent. But after that, I sort of messed around for a bit and went and travelled and all that kind of stuff. And then eventually kind of realised, oh, maybe it's journalism.
So was journalism the obvious thing that you were then going to do, or were there a few other kind of competing choices?
I think actually, you know, I vividly remember working in an off licence and listening to the radio, and it was probably LBC and not ever incarnation out of that time, and thinking that, you know, that I got all these issues they were discussing and was frustrated by some of the failure of the people doing the show to kind of really grasp them, or the contributors, and I thought I could kind of do that. I didn't have a plan of how to get into a position to do it. I didn't do any courses or anything like that. But I suppose that was the kind of seed.
And in your mind's eye, what kind of journalist did you think you would become at that point? Was it kind of Woodward and Bernstein going to bring down the White House and all this kind of stuff?
No, actually, I think it was telly, actually, probably. Or TV or radio, probably telly, because I just recall that the hours I spent in my youth, when I should have been out partying, probably, as a teenager, in the 80s, watching political programmes and the news and just enjoying the theatre of that.
I don't know about you, but I still do that now. I love all that. Even when the news channel or any news program changes its graphics, I'm like really interested, thinking, oh, they're trying it with two presenters this time and there's a glass background. Yeah. They're always just rejigging the same variables, aren't they?
Yeah, but the great thing is you don't realise that you're kind of training yourself in some way, but by observing all that stuff and taking an interest in it. So when it comes to some way down the track, you're kind of working on what's the format of this show or what's the best way. You have some instincts built upon your kind of own experiences of it, which you draw upon. And so that was probably going on. So that was probably why, when it came to it, the chance to do... I don't think I was ever attracted to doing print. You know, the chance to do telly was pretty, you know, attractive.
And did you want to be behind the camera or in front of it?
Oh, definitely behind. Never interested in anything but that.
And did you do another mail shot then, when you decided that kind of behind the camera journalism was for you? Was there another 50 letters sent off? How did you get your first job then?
Well, actually, there was a channel which I'm sure listeners will remember, called Granada Talk TV. Do you remember that?
I do remember it, yeah. I am a really sad media geek, so I do remember these kind of things.
Well, but this was very important for me because it was a Granada channel. I don't know what number it was. It was, you know, it was somewhere down in the schedules, but it was a channel devoted to talk. So a format you think might be more suited to radio, really. But the idea was let's have kind of discussion shows on telly, and it will run a schedule of that all day long, you know, from kind of nine until sort of six.
Was it quite a shoestring operation, really, as I recall?
Oh, really shoestring. But, you know, we had people like the most famous participant, I don't know if you remember, was the children's TV presenter on that channel, because there was a children's show with Sacha Baron Cohen.
IG, of course. Where the Borat then? And, you know, Bruno.
Yeah, exactly. And so he went on to, you know, huge things. But so that was the chance, get through the door there. They had this technology at the time, which was a video phone, which was kind of a sort of a primitive version, I suppose, of what you'd expect. You get, everyone has a Skype now, but it was done over these big sort of I can't remember how, what they looked like, but they were kind of contraptions that would be placed in this case the lobby of the conference hotel in Blackpool for the Labour Party conference of 1996, and I was sent there to try and get, you know, Peter Mandelson through the door to appear on a video phone. And succeeded, actually.
I was going to say, I'm sure he'd be delighted to appear. He was over at the video phone, known Peter.
Yeah, yeah, he wasn't that hard to persuade. But that was how I got in there. I think a friend of mine actually was already working there and kind of managed to help me get a foot in the door. So that was it. And then that was within Granada, which was part of an LWT in Granada, were kind of related. And that's how I ended up going from there to the Jonathan Dimbleby programme as a researcher.
Did you see that as the kind of first rung on the ladder, as it were, something that was always going to be a springboard to... I mean, how ambitious were you, I suppose, is the question.
I probably was ambitious to progress, but I don't think I knew the trajectory or the process or, you know, where you go from there. All I knew was there was in the department, although in a different building, a political show. And given I was interested in it and was good at it, there was a chance that I might get a chance, might be able to go there. So when the job came up, you know, 6 months after I started in the satellite channel, I kind of went for it, and that was it.
So that was quite an exciting time for you then, because you'd worked in politics, you wanted to be, as you know, around the political scene, but there you are now actually doing it as a TV journalist, producer, I should say.
Yeah, well, a researcher then. I mean, that's the contrast between, you know, not particularly enjoying the parliamentary side of it. When you are at that time researching on the show with, and it's John Major, he's the Prime Minister, he's in front of an audience, it's the election, and he's, you know, you're working closely on the content of that. That is the excitement, because that's a dramatic moment, especially if you're interested in politics. This is an election. You've got the Prime Minister in front of you and you're helping to formulate the question. So that was...
Did you ever get starstruck? I used to get starstruck all the time. Well, anyone who was, you know, any of the major A-listers, if you were, you know, when I worked at Parliament, they'd walk past you in Central Lobby and I'd be like, just a normal person walking past me.
I do remember that, actually, from Parliament. I remember sort of Paddy Ashton sort of thrusting down the corridor, you know, in his sort of military bearing, and thinking, God, blimey. But I think what I noticed, things like John Major, he had a lot of charisma.
Yeah.
He was on the show, actually, on the Mar show just before Christmas. He's still got it. He's quite a charismatic guy.
We're doing this chronologically, so I'll get into the Mar show later, but I can't resist this. I mean, obviously, the Mar show gets the very cream of the cream, the absolute A-listers from the Prime Minister upwards on the global scene.
Yeah.
That must be the most amazing show and the most amazing privilege to be the editor of.
Absolutely, and that's what I was saying about that moment of the excitement, which I didn't get in Parliament, but I did get when I was on those shows with the Prime Minister, is to sort of be running a show where you get those people all the time.
Does it work a lot on autopilot, as it were? So, you know, it's the new year, so you know you're going to have the Prime Minister on then. And is there a framework of a year's show is already kind of mapped out?
Somewhat. I mean, there are two points when you'll get the Prime Minister, traditionally. We hope long may it continue. And obviously you need to maintain that relationship.
Well, you do, because Tony famously boycotted the Today programme for many years. Didn't even appear on it.
Well, it can change. And so, you know, you need to manage that. So David Cameron, in this case, will do the first show in the new year, and also will do the Tory Party conference. And similarly for the Labour leader. Those are the fixed points. Beyond that, you might get the Labour leader another time. You're unlikely to get the Prime Minister another time, but it's not impossible. Sometimes it happens. Obviously, in an election year, it would be different because you get the Prime Minister during the campaign as well.
Do you ever just chance your arm? Do you ever just write to, you know, Craig Oliver and just say, can we have him on again? You know, just on the off chance.
Yeah, occasionally you do that. And I mean, it happened with Jeremy Corbyn the end of last year when the Syria vote was coming. We sort of got him on Saturday night.
Didn't he pull out of one of his shows at short notice?
We had an undertaking from all of the candidates in the leadership campaign, and that they would the leadership election, that they would appear on the Mar show the following day, including the Corbyn team. And when it came to it, they decided that they didn't want to. And I mean, I can understand why. I mean, he just got the job. He had a lot to do.
You got Tom Watson on instead,
didn't
you?
Tom Watson came on.
It was quite a good interview.
It was very
interesting. And it was quite raw because he was quite open and in terms of with Andrew, wasn't he, about what he did and didn't know. It was quite I thought it was quite an unusual interview, actually. Credit to Tom.
I've thought about that. Oh, I'm not sure.
The one I've used all the time because I don't quite know what I'm doing.
But New Labour used to do that at the beginning of their time. They used to be more willing to say, you know, I'm not sure. Well, I think New Labour. That had changed, as you saw in the leadership campaign, when most of the candidates in that weren't there. They were sort of media trained to within an inch of their lives.
Let me be disciplined and go back to where we were, really. Mm-hmm. You were working with Jonathan Dibble. What was it like to work with him, and what? How did your role evolve while you were there?
Well, so this show was a kind of inheritor show. You know, it was in this Weekend World that started it. So Peter Mandelson worked on that. John Burt worked on that.
All the greats.
Brian Walden presented, and then the Walden show came after that. So this was they were built around these interviews that lasted. In those, 40 minutes, and there would be interview plans that thick. I'm holding my hands quite wide apart, because if he says X to question
two, it's
like
a flowchart.
Yeah, you would turn to page 43.
Amazing.
And that would be it was like
it is me with like three bullet points. Yeah, honestly,
if that. Yeah. So that was the difference. And so there was a really forensic approach to interviewing politicians and holding them to account. And that was and this program sort of latest incarnation of that. And the format was Jonathan with a studio audience on a Sunday, an interview.
I remember the show.
Yeah, about 20-25 minute interview followed by a studio audience, and it came right at that time. And I mentioned the John Major, the run up to the 1997 election when you had these. The Conservative Party in a lot of trouble over Europe, over, I remember issues like the NHS were very toxic for them. Virginia Bottomley, I remember on the show at one point, a lot of trouble with people very angry. At the same time, you had this new Labour, fresh-faced team coming through as well. So it was, you felt something was happening. And having the studio audience there every Sunday was just a different way of doing that forensic interview. I don't know whether there was a bit of a mismatch sometimes between this incredibly detailed forensic interview and the audience, you probably either at home or in the studio, not necessarily following what exactly was going on because it was so complex. But it was fantastic training.
And did you start to get feedback from your friends and family, people in the normal side of your life that would start to watch the program because they knew someone on the production team and start to give you feedback as an honest viewer? Did you ever listen to people like that, or was that something?
I don't know, really.
Do you ever, I mean, does it happen now where you're in the pub, people know that you edit the Mar show and they say, well, why didn't Andrew ask Gordon Brown that? Why didn't he push him harder on whether he took prescription, antidepressants and all this kind of thing?
Yeah, well, that was all before my time, that questioning, but the Gordon Brown thing.
Yeah, very good. Very good caveat
yeah,
there.
Yeah, people, it's great. This show and Newsnight are the... Because when you're working in TV, you kind of think, hey, everyone knows about this stuff. But this show and Newsnight are the two shows that I've worked on that people talk about the most and know about. And you do get feedback because they're big shows.
What happened after Dimbleby?
So after that period working as a researcher, then I became a producer on the Dimbleby programme. And then I left for a while and went to work on Tonight with Trevor MacDonald.
Another legend.
Yeah, great man, lovely man.
Your Rolodex must be amazing. I imagine it's an iPhone now, but
it's a pleasure to work with people like that because he's just a very nice man, and that show was very different and really interesting, but it was more film, it was filmmaking and it was a different kind of thing. And then I came back after doing that and some books I did to be deputy editor on Dimbleby, and then editor of Dimbleby.
What was that like? Your first position as editor. Did you feel like a sense of burdensome responsibility, or was it excitement? Did you think, right, this is it, now I've arrived? I mean, I've spoken to a lot of my friends who have reached, reasonably prestigious jobs, and some of them have said secretly there's a slight sense of fear and anti-climax as well, like, OK, I'm here now, I've worked for decades to get to this, what next, what should I do?
Yeah, I definitely had plans, for that show, because we were in a situation there that the show was on ITV, we were up against Frost, and I think Mar, actually, towards the end of it, we weren't, we weren't even bidding for the Prime Minister at that point because they just stopped coming on.
What could you get, Chief Secretary to the Treasury? I mean, what was the level that you got?
Well, we got good cabinet ministers, but we weren't getting the Prime Minister. We weren't getting the Chancellor. We're talking here about the Blair government. The Prime Minister, Blair had never been on outside of an election, i.e. when he was Prime Minister there, therefore, and Brown had never come anywhere near it. So it was, and we just weren't doing as well. And I think it was, you know, that's because it was challenging for them. It wasn't appealing necessarily to them to come onto a show with an audience, you know, on a Sunday when people underestimate how much they, you know, politicians might just want to be at home and not come and be questioned on a Sunday. So my ambition for the show was pretty clear that we needed to get them again. And we needed to build relationships with them and put the show kind of back where it needed to be.
So how do you do that? Because clearly you can't promise them an easy ride journalistically. What do you do? Take their special advisors out for lunch? Or do you just kind of write them a nice letter saying, give us another go, I'm a new editor, broom and all that? What do you actually do that?
I think you just see people. You reintroduce yourself or the show to them. And make arguments or come up with a concept. So in the case of Blair, we said it was all in this kind of period when he was just going on to programmes to be berated about Iraq.
The so-called masochism strategy.
Exactly right. And this masochism strategy was an audience of women, only women in the audience, to question him about Iraq. And so it was if you come up with a twist like that, then they might just bite, and that's what happened. And
did any of them turn, you know, during, as if to say, he might have a point, I don't hate him as much as I did before start of the programme, or was it just a disaster from start to finish?
Well, he just got criticised from start to finish by them. I think in that case, it was clear that all of them would be critics. We weren't attempting to produce a balanced audience. So it was clear that they were people who were unhappy with the decision, but also wanted to talk to him about it, and were open to voting for him again, which, of course, this is in the run-up to 2005. A lot, you know, people did, actually. People forget that he got elected after Iraq.
Absolutely, for a third term.
Yeah.
Ostensibly for a full third term, if you remember.
Yeah.
I don't know where that went. But what's the most exciting part of the kind of procedure and the stages of it? Because there you are, you've got Blair in the room with a lot of women that hate him. Is it the preparation of the programme, or is the adrenaline going while the recording's taking place so much that you can't actually focus on anything else other than just getting it done? Or is it afterwards? What is it?
I think there's two things. One is, I think sometimes if you're on the studio floor in a moment like that, when the Prime Minister walks into that room and there's a kind of audible intake of breath as people are, oh, is it actually him? You know, this is an event. And then the other thing that for me is in the gallery, you know, when you're doing talk back and you're engaged in the programme, that's the buzz.
I mean, how much do you use talk back is the question I could just put as bluntly as that, because I suppose it depends on the presenter, doesn't it? Someone like Andrew Marr's a very experienced political journalist in his own right. He can ask his own questions, but are you also whispering in his ear from time to time saying you need to mention this particular fact or push him a bit hard on that? How does it actually work?
I mean, they're all different, and the moment you kind of really enjoy, I suppose, is when you say something on talk back and they then say it on air, and that sometimes happens, and quite rare, but that's not because they don't know how to ask questions, but because
you've just been, the right question at the right time.
Yeah, and you've been working with them. You know, so if you're working with Jeremy Paxman on Newsnight, he's interested in what you've got to say, and will be interested in how you're kind of judging the interview as it goes out live. So you're slightly outside the interview, so you can kind of judge it. And it's really satisfying, and sometimes that, you know, leads to moments that really work.
And are those best moments the kind of impromptu ones where you drop an impromptu question in Jeremy's ear and then it gets asked, or do you have your own list of questions where you think he hasn't asked about inflation strongly enough, so I just want to come up with another angle?
Both. So it's a collaboration. So the interview plan, which is usually about a side or two of A4, you won't necessarily get across all of that material, but that's what you've been discussing with the presenter in the run-up to the interview, and you might want to pull him back or her back to that a particular question. Or you're right, there might be a moment when you just think of something that comes to you, and then they pick it up, and that creates that sort of magic moment.
What interests me about an interview plan is how you actually draft it. What's the process? I mean, do you sit around a table and... I mean, sometimes the questions are obvious, aren't they? If something's going on, or it's Syria or whatever it might be, you've got a certain number of questions. And also, is it just the questions themselves? Because sometimes you might have to decide tonally how far you're going to push this.
Yeah, all of those things, that's all correct. Yeah, so it's... In terms of how you construct it, you know, it depends on the timetable of a programme, you know, how much time you've got to do it. But in a weekly show, like with Jonathan Dimbleby, we would spend time in the week on the Friday going through, talking about the issues and then boiling it down. And then by the time you get to Sunday morning, you have a kind of agreed plan and an agreed tone or approach to an interview. So you need to think about all of those things. And it's not just about a list of questions in no particular order. It's about a kind of, well, going back to that document, the Weekend World document, if the person says X.
And building up a kind of narrative as well, having a coherency to it.
Yeah, and a pressure.
And do you anticipate their response? Because, I mean, if someone's asked about a difficult issue and you've heard them answer it in an evasive way on a show 2 or 3 days early, do you think, right, if he then says that, we're going to push him on saying, well, actually, no. How does that work? So it's a little bit if then, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm also a big fan of role playing before the interviews.
So do you pretend? Are you the guy who's the politician?
Yeah, you do some of that. So that just helps to kind of focus the editor and the presenter, and about what might be said, anticipate their answers, try and close off a particular route they might be planning to go down. So yeah, you do that, and it just all helps to get them sort of match fit, and ready to go.
What do you feel when the credits roll on a program when it's live? Is it an enormous sense of relief, or because I've spoken to some people and they say actually it's quite unnerving because they've still got lots of adrenaline running around and they've got nothing to do with it at that point, so it's slightly kind of weird come down. Or is there a debrief? How does it work?
Depends on the show. I mean, Newsnight always had a debrief, which at that time of night you're not necessarily in the mood for, but you'd have a debrief.
Peter Barron used to bugger off during the recording. He told this podcast and do the debrief via telephone. So,
well, that's very wise, very wise indeed. Yeah. So there's sometimes a debrief. I don't really detect any. I have any sense of kind of anticlimax or a problem with adrenaline, but with Mar, we often have music at the end, so there's an opportunity to sort of like the viewer will. Just change into a slightly different mode. You've got out of the politics, you've got some music. It's a soft landing. That's fine.
Is it stressful, though, when you know that you've got the Prime Minister on and you've got 4 minutes, 10 seconds left before the guy with the saxophone does his thing, and therefore you've got 3 questions left and can you ask? I mean, that must be quite difficult to make that choice.
Well, that's you can do something about that if you're sitting in the gallery and you're the editor of the programme, but really that's the talent of the presenter who knows how to get us from A to B there.
So would you just drop a word in his or her ear that just says 3 minutes?
Oh, yeah.
How would they know?
Yeah, there's timing. So there'll be on each segment then, but there'll be sort of 2 minutes to go. There'll be, if you're right at the end, there'll be, 3 minutes, can't go over. 2 minutes, can't go over. 1 minute, final question, that kind of stuff. But they don't always need that level of, they'll need a timing, but they'll know themselves. Andrew Marr is, incredibly skilled at bringing that to an end. Smoothly into his closing link, and then we have some music, if we have music.
So just going back to your career, I'm determined to kind of keep going, progressing through this, even though we kind of meander off.
Yeah.
So what happened after ITV? How long were you there in total?
I was there from 96 till 2006, so 10 years, yeah.
Long time.
So then I was freelance then for a bit, which was a bit of a rude awakening, to be honest. And I think, and for anyone who's, people interested in kind of career and career trajectory, I sort of learned that you sometimes have to go down to go back up again.
Mm.
And being freelance was hard. I found it sort of quite unsettling. But I had to do, I worked on Teachers TV for a while. I went from those moments with those big politicians to working on a kind of show on Teachers TV, which was a channel for teachers. So, you just have to take the work sometimes and then try and build up and get back to where you want to be. And it's sort of, that was a process that took me to the BBC and, having to do things I'd never done, like working on breakfast, outputting breakfast, which I'd never done anything like that before, until I was able to kind of get back to where I am now, which is obviously kind of dream job situation.
What's the difference in culture in terms of producing these kind of similar programmes between ITV and the BBC? There's the whole cliche, the BBC's over-resourced, the ITV will have 2 people on a show and they'll have 22 and all that. What's the reality of it? And what's the good and bad for both sides?
I think in terms of resourcing, I look back on the resourcing we had at ITV on that show, and certainly on the Dimbleby show, and it was pretty good. It became less good as time went on, and the Sunday edition was under resourced in my view, and didn't last very long. I think I suppose the main thing is there are, and it's a good thing and a bad thing at the BBC. There are so many more people who are engaged in what you're doing. The guidelines about what you do. There obviously are guidelines in terms of broadcasting guidelines for ITV, but it's not the same. The positive side of that is, impartiality is written into what the BBC does, and it's a value that we, that I'm personally very committed to.
But ITV is equally bound by the Broadcasting Act.
Yeah, but it's not. You don't talk about it in the same way. It's not. There's not meetings about it and things. There was just a team of us, journalists, who kind of
go on with it.
Go on with it, and you have someone like Jonathan Dimbleby, who gets all that, so you're in safe hands. And in other words, it was never explained, or it was just kind of understood. And it happened, and that was good, really. But then I also, like I say, I do value the fact that that's written into what the BBC does in a more profound way.
Is the BBC less agile in terms of its production, in terms of the actual mechanics of getting it done, because it's not a commercial operation?
I wouldn't really say so, particularly. I don't feel that, no. There's great people who work there, so that's the main thing, and who can turn things around quickly. I mean, at Newsnight, I was just amazed sometimes. You might have one fixed thing that you knew was in the show. You get in at 10:30 for the meeting to talk about what's going to happen that night. And, you know, somehow all these people would achieve this slick, engaging, varied programme from scratch. BBC Breakfast, another a completely different kind of show, but the presenters who work on that show, for example, as well as the team, you know, they have very limited time to get their heads around topics. Yeah, they're able to do interviews of a high quality, suitable to the audience that they serve. I've been pretty impressed, really, by the BBC. I mean, to be honest, I feel much more at home there than I ever did at ITV.
It doesn't necessarily apply as much to kind of journalist and news-based programmes, but a lot of people think presenting TV programmes is quite an easy job, really, that it's just, if you're a bit of a card and a bit of a character and you've got a personality, that you should do it. But clearly there's a craft to it. It's quite technical and quite difficult.
Absolutely, yeah, it really is. I mean, it depends on what, you know, what kind of presenting it is, I suppose. But if you are presenting Breakfast, you are having to... as well as read autocue in a way that is clear and conversational and engaging, and talk to somebody who's come on because they've got a story about, I don't know, a family illness, and you know, they're campaigning for some change in the law related to it, and then turn to a politician down the line from Milbank and grill them about, you know, policy that's just broken that day, and you've had 10 minutes to digest it. That's quite impressive stuff. I came from this tradition of the 47-page document, and then I go into BBC Breakfast where there's very little. It's just you rest a lot on the talents of the presenters. So I think you can't underestimate how skilled a job it is. And, you know, it'd be interesting to give it a go, wouldn't it? I wonder, I mean, you're doing it here now, but, you know, in that sort of setting, it's quite hard. It would be very hard.
Testament to their skill. I've sometimes sat next to an anchor while they've been reading. It'll be fluent off the autocue, but then it'll suddenly just say ad lib, and they will continue to be as fluent without even so much as a beat. And I think that's bloody amazing.
It is amazing. And there's some great, it's some things, you know, it sounds cheesy, but I've been privileged to work with these kind of broadcasters, some brilliant people, and some of their interview. Emily Maitlis, for example, is hugely impressive at Newsnight. I think she's one of the best I've ever worked with. Her interviews are fantastic.
Well, she did that interview in French, didn't she? In Paris recently.
Yeah.
I thought that was absolutely amazing.
She is. She's extraordinary. And I don't think you can underestimate the skill involved in doing that sort of job.
And do you think the kind of variety in different questioning styles and interviewing styles and their personality and the variety of that is something that is to be welcomed, really? Because you watch Newsnight when Paxman presents because you want him to have a go at these people and sneer at them. In a sense, you kind of almost enjoy it. But then sometimes you think it gets in the way where they put people too much on the defensive, and it kind of creates that. I mean, one of the worst interviews I always used to think is if it was, say, Harriet Harman, who's over media trained in my view and would never answer any questions, with someone like Paxman, because the whole thing would be a waste of time. Sometimes, you know, you listen to the Today programme and it might be Humphreys versus whoever, and you think, oh, I might even just put Radio 2 on because we're not going to get anything out of this. Do you think that's unfair?
Well, it sort of depends what you want, I think. I think there's a place for theatre, and theatre. Paxman, when he, you know, was theatre, wasn't he? You would wanted to watch him. You wanted to see what he was going to do and what he was going to say. That was probably what you were most interested in, rather than necessarily...
Is he going to break them?
Rather than learning something from the interviewee. So there is a place for that, but I don't think it's the only way. And I think it can be, as you describe, you know, frustrating for people and a bit pointless.
How important do you think it is in terms of the interview style of the presenter? Because like Andrew Marr, for example, he's quite polite and respectful. He's certainly not as, say, gladiatorial as Paxman and so on. And in many ways, you know, some people might criticise him for that, saying he's letting people off. But in another sense, I often think he gets more out of the interviewees because he gives them the space to talk and necessarily hang themselves.
Yeah, although it's not all an exercise in kind of gotcha. You know, it's actually important that people... politicians have the chance to explain what they think and what they're doing, and it's not just about catching them out in, you know, some lie or in some deception of some kind, because they're not always doing that. I mean, there's a kind of cynicism about politicians. I mean, we probably haven't the time to explain, to go into all the reasons for that. But partly it's politicians' fault. It might be partly the sort of interviewer's fault. But the point is, it's important to hear what they have to say, as well as to hold them to account on it. So I think in Andrew's case, that's what he's interested in hearing is what they think, and then testing it. Whereas some other interviews, you feel the assumption is, you're lying to me.
Why is this lying bastard lying to me?
Yeah, that's the classic, isn't it? Yeah, that was the classic Paxman thing. That's how people saw those interviews. And it depends. Also, you know, if it was Newsnight and it's that time of night, then it was a different feel. I mean, different presenters on Newsnight, from Emily Maitlis to Evan Davis, do it very differently.
Both of them very impressive.
Indeed. Yeah, absolutely. And they take a very different approach. Forensic at times, but conversational at other times. And our show, you know, our show is a Sunday morning show. I mean, Andrew Neil, by the way, who does a fantastic political show a little bit later in the morning, is the very best, in my view, at those forensic, hard-hitting political interviews.
I wouldn't want to cross Andrew Neil. No. He's my hero.
He's amazing.
Brilliant.
He's extraordinary.
I love it when people try to have a go at him as well, like particularly Nigel Farage. Why does he even bother trying to have a go? Because he's automatically toast already.
There's only one winner. There's only one winner there. I've worked with him and I loved working with him. But Andrew is doing something different. He's doing something on BBC One at 9 o'clock. People have got out of bed. They've switched they're in bed. They've switched the telly on. The kids are around. And most people who aren't sort of political junkies just actually do want to hear what these people are saying. At least at first, and then they want those people to be tested, and that's what I think we do. And so, we don't let anybody off, but we do let them speak, and that's important. And the show has got a mix of things. That's why it has arts and it has, you know, it has music and all those things in it, as well as a style that is more approachable at that time of the morning. It's a product that I think works and hangs together, but it is journalistically rigorous as well.
You ever ruthlessly abuse your position insofar as, you know, you might be jogging along and listening to a U2 album on your iPod and think, do you know, I've never met Bono. I think let's try and get him on the show, knowing that that's the you get the A-listers who's probably going to come on. Have you ever thought, I actually want this person on, so let's get them on?
When it comes to the music we have on, I mean, what is your criteria? How do you decide who's going to be on a show? It's all about opinion and judgment, and sometimes you'll book people that you particularly like. Although actually, I think it's always a bad idea. I mean, it's a cliche, but it's a bad idea to meet your heroes. I'm not sure it's really a good idea to do that. So not that Bono really is one of mine. So I don't know if I would say abuse position, but certainly you use your subjective judgments and your taste to sort of shape what you have on. So I guess to that extent, yeah.
And how does it work juggling quite a number of other responsibilities? Because, I mean, Mars, a Sunday morning show, there's a lot to do, but it is 1 hour. So clearly you have got time to do other things. But, you know, you're deputy editor of the Live Political Output, you run Newswatch. You must work a lot of hours.
I haven't totted them up, but I'm kept busy, yeah. So, I mean, I'm not the only deputy editor. There's two deputy editors on Live Political Programme. So there's my colleague Will Bowden, who works on Daily Politics a lot of the time, and all those things. There's that. There's Newswatch, which I love, actually. I enjoy Newswatch. It's a very...
You won't be surprised to know that I'm a Newswatch fan.
Yes, it's a good show. And really interesting.
It's a great show, in fact.
Yeah, really good. And James Mallett is the producer on that show, so he's done it a long time and knows his way around it, and, you know, brings out the issues that are bothering viewers on the in terms of the news output. If people haven't seen it, you know, it's essentially about our news output, the BBC's news output, and it relies upon BBC executives coming and answering the questions and criticisms of the viewers, and it's really interesting because you'll get particular stories that people are interested in, or particular treatments or ways things have been done they want to talk about. But also, if there's a big story, you're guaranteed that will be your story that week. It will just be, how did the BBC do the Paris attacks? How did it cover that story? How did it cover this, that, the other? So you sort of, it's a different angle at all the main stories of the week.
It's like almost like a meta-analysis of the news, because you're talking about the reporting of it rather than the actual thing itself. And is it shaped by the criticism? I mean, you run a lot of video clips and you even have people in the studio and down the line, regular, genuine viewers that say, you place too much emphasis on this, and then it'll cut to the BBC executive will say, the BBC's values are this, that, and the other. Yeah.
The best BBC executive on Newswatch will say, you know, it's hard. I wasn't sure if that was the right way to go, but in the end, on balance, we made this judgment or that judgment. And that way, it lets people... Well, I think where it's at its best is where it lets people in on the process of... Because these things aren't clear-cut. Sometimes decisions have to be made, editorial decisions are made, choices are made. And BBC execs who sort of who engage in that, I think, allow viewers to understand it, and then they'll be more sympathetic to them.
Literally because they've, you know, they've paid behind the curtain, as it were.
Yeah.
And they know a little bit about the challenges that you face getting the news out.
Yeah, and the choices you make about, do we show that thing, do we show the other thing, should we do this, should we do that, what are our choices, where do we send reporters, all of those things. You know, I think people might think there are just powerful people who make decisions and it's easy for them and they decide things and they don't worry about it. But actually they do. They think about these things a lot. They turn them over in their minds. What's the best way of doing it? And it's when they come on and explain that process, you know, well, we made this choice for that reason or that reason, and maybe it was wrong. That sort of, I think it works well for viewers.
How much can you prepare when you're producing live political programmes? Because having been at the edges of this for many, many years, a lot of it is, particularly like on election night or if it's budget, a lot of it is who's available by when, you know, where are the guests, what can you ask them? Is it all complete adrenaline-driven seat-of-the-pants stuff, having to fill in time while this guest, you know, rushes from the house to Millbank, et cetera, et cetera? Or is it less chaotic than people might imagine?
Well, my experience of that is not, I mean, I've not worked a lot in news. I've been more in programmes, but Newsnight was a kind of hybrid of those two things. Current affairs programme is on every day. It is quite a thrill, and it is often thrown together. You know, Ian Katz, who when he became editor, I came and started working on the show. You know, very much was committed to introducing things into the show late. So if something happened to Harper's Nine, you know, we weren't going to stay on what we had necessarily if something interesting had happened somewhere in the world. And so, yeah, there were moments when we were trying to throw everything up at the last minute. I mean, I remember my very first news night, which I ever was the Syria vote in 2013. So we went on air as the vote was coming in. And we knew that Philip Hammond, the then defence secretary, was making his way as soon as the vote was finished from Millbank to the studio NBH, which is in central London.
Yeah, so he's not going to get... you don't want him down the line for Millbank then?
No, we'd much rather have him in the studio. And of course, the expectation on that day was that they were going to win that vote. And then as the vote came in, as we were going on, we were typing in the script of those numbers as they came in, it turned out that they'd lost the vote. And so, you know, we then had Allegra Stratton, who's the political editor at that time, talking about what happened, trying to deal with the implications of it. And then Philip Hammond is sort of slightly breathlessly then introduced, and Paxman turns to him, and it's a moment because something unexpected has happened. Those are great moments. Those are really exciting. So they can happen. I mean, like I say, I've mainly been programmed. So a show like The Mar Show, it's a pretty high bar if you're going to change. I mean, we did after Paris. Obviously, Paris happened on a Friday night. So the whole planned show was essentially changed and junked that night, and in the Saturday we reconstructed what we were doing. So that can happen, but you know, that's not sort of a change on the morning, although that may happen. Something big enough could happen on a Sunday morning when we had to react. So
is it fairly, not necessarily that you're on autopilot, but when something like that so monumentally bad or newsworthy happens, should I say, the Mar Show's not about simply repeating what happened, because that's what the news channels for and the news programmes. But in a sense, you know, you're going to go to a reporter on the scene, you're going to want someone in the government to comment on it. Maybe then, do you think, well, we'll need someone from the opposition to balance it, or do you have a journalist on? What's the kind of mix? How does it work?
So that'll depend when it happens. If you want to use Paris as an example, I mean, clearly the guest we wanted was the Home Secretary. So that was our whole focus initially, was
to say, is she going to tighten up on or crack down on X, Y, and Z because of the perceived Muslim threat?
We had a serious attack in a capital city not very far away, and you know, it was important for us to have somebody on who could talk about the British approach to that threat. So she's the best person to do that.
But isn't she going to be inundated with requests from innumerable shows?
Of course, yeah. And this is where, you know, we are very lucky. It's not pure luck, because like I say, we do let people speak. We let people say what they want to say as well as test them. We provide them with a forum that's worth kind of participating in. That's where we, you know, I hope remain in pole position to land that person if they want to talk about that on the Sunday morning. So we were very happy that she was willing to do that. And then what else did we do? You know, so we brought in the French ambassador because we wanted to hear the French perspective. I think we had Emily Maitlis down the line from Paris as well to get a sense of what was going on. And also, it's probably one of my proudest moments in the time I've done the show, was we had music. I can't remember what we had booked previously, but we found a French opera singer from the Royal Opera House to come and do the national anthem at the close of the show. And, you know, it was a very moving moment, particularly for the French ambassador. And, you know, I've spoken to French people I know in this country who said that they watched that show and they felt that there was a, you know, we understood the significance of the moment for them. So those are the things you can do on a TV show, even at the last minute, that will just lift it. And it wasn't just about interviewing people, it was about the emotion of the situation as well. So that, there's an example of, and you know, that was obviously, we didn't start on that programme until Saturday morning or Friday night.
What do you feel about Peston moving to become your competition and have a competing show on the Sunday? Because I'm a news geek. I'll Sky Plus both of them and watch both. So, you know,
you're all right.
Yeah. But, you know, will someone think, I've had enough of Andrew, I've watched him for X number of years, so I'm now going to give a try on Peston? How do you think that works? How do you differentiate yourself? Do you feel slightly threatened?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, as we've talked about, I mean, I used to do the ITV political show. I've got a sort of emotional attachment to the idea that ITV, with all the commercial constraints of ITV, you know, does serious programming like that. So I'm pleased, really, genuinely. I don't know when they'll put it out. You know, will it be? I would think it's up to them whether they want to put it out at the same time as
our
show.
There's been no start time advertised yet. It's not going to go head to head against you guys.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not privy to any of that. So it's fine as far as I'm concerned. I think it's a good thing. I mean, it's not just us. I mean, there's the Sunday Politics, which is a fantastic show, also on a Sunday morning on the BBC One. So how will they differentiate themselves? I don't know. I'm not going to advise them on what they should do to differentiate themselves. I'm sure they've got their own ideas, but he's a very different guy to Andrew, or to Andrew Neil as well. So I don't know.
You're competing against other BBC shows for these guests as well. I mean, because the Home Secretary might have wanted a bit of a lie-in on the Sunday, and they think, I'll do the Sunday Politics instead of Ma.
Yeah, I mean, they do get very good guests. It's a very different kind of interview. But, you know, the fact is, we have some structural advantages as well. You know, we are on first at 9 a.m. We set the agenda. They're not the kind of people that really worry about lie-in. They want to get it done, move on. She had to go and, you know, chair Cobra immediately afterwards. So we have those advantages which do help us. And we also have a good audience. And I think people enjoy the mix of this show. It's not just a political show. Will Robert Peston offer a breadth of subject matter around the arts? I'd be surprised, but you never know. Probably business. There'll be a bit more business. I don't know how much of a turn on that is for audience. It's important. So, you know, there's obviously a place for it.
It's a differentiator, isn't
it? Yeah, it is. And obviously he's in a strong position from that point of view. Whether we feel in competition with them or not remains to be seen, and we'll see. But I'm glad, genuinely, I know it sounds nonsense, but I'm actually really glad it's happening, because I think it's good that ITV do that, and they should never have got rid of the ITV political programme when they did. So, you know, on that level, I'm pleased.
How do you keep your eyes peeled for, you know, fresh talent when it comes to, like, the newspaper reviewers or people who are going to stand in for Andrew when he's away? I mean, I imagine you must receive a lot of CVs from people who are a few rungs down the ladder, should I say, that will be desperate to stand in for Andrew when he has his holidays or whatever.
The people who are in a position to do that are quite senior presenters at the BBC. So when Andrew was obviously Andrew was off ill for a period of time a few years ago, Sophie Raworth did the show a lot, and she's very, very good. Jeremy Vine did the show, James Landale, and recently Emily Maitlis covered for him as well. So there are, you know, we're very fortunate. There are lots of really good people that we can call upon, and
you have the kind of usual suspects that you can go to automatically, as it were. You wouldn't think of trying out kind of someone.
Well, Eddie Mayer did it as well one time, not before my time. So he was obviously someone who's a radio.
That was the famous one when Boris was on, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was quite a memorable interview.
It was memorable. Yeah, it was quite confrontational, quite different for the show. So yeah, I mean, I'm not against. I'm open to new faces there, but these are people that there has to be someone who can carry the Andrew Marr show.
But I remember once turning on Newsnight and James O'Brien was presenting it, and he tweeted, "They're trying me out tonight as a presenter." And I thought, is that how they do it now?
That's interesting, isn't it? I mean, Newsnight is a different thing in that there's another one along in a minute. You know, there's and sometimes you just have to give people a chance to see if they can do it. So it does happen like that sometimes. There's a lot of shows, whereas the Marr show is a weekly show. You have to be able to interview the Home Secretary if that's what appears that day. So you need a certain level of status. But I mean, I think James O'Brien has proved, actually, having done some news nights, that he's a talent, and, you know, so
big fan of James O'Brien.
Yeah, it's worked well for him.
How does it work in terms of when the politicians come off air? Do they give you a critique of that they felt that you were too hard on them sometimes, or do they just know that, you know, they already know how the rules of the game and they just leave, or do they give you feedback?
Usually only in a bad way, I'd say. If you know, occasionally, this is not, I'm just not talking about Marr, but you know, their people might come back to you if they didn't like a particular interview. That used to happen on dim, albeit times.
What, you'd get an email or a letter saying...
You might get
some
a
kind of
phone
note.
Call.
Yeah.
You know, you might get a phone call after the show from somebody having a bit of a go about something. It doesn't really happen on Mar. On Mar, actually, we do have... I don't know if people are aware of this. We have a breakfast after the show with the team and with the guests. Now, they don't all always come, but most of the time they do. And so there's a... There'll be a very kind of good-natured conversation then, and they might include comment on what had happened, but usually they just want to have a chat about stuff.
Interesting.
Yeah.
How are you judged as an editor? Because clearly there's the viewing figures, the editorial tone, your audience appreciation index, what your mum and dad think, but how does it fit in the mix? How do you know whether someone's been a good editor of that show or someone who's performed poorly? Because it's quite intangible, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I came after an editor, Barney Jones, who's a bit of a legend in this kind of world.
Very much so.
Who for 20 years did the Frost show and then the Mar show. So in a sense, my attitude was... You know, can I continue? Viewers who didn't know that wouldn't think that something dramatic had changed. But can I continue, but then also refresh and do things that are creative in it? And so you hope that that will be picked up on. So, you know, you hope when you do a very good interview, that will be picked up on by senior people. You hope when you have the French national anthem at that moment in an emotional way, you've, you know, reinvented slightly the way in which you use music on the show, and you hope that's appreciated. I think you know if you're doing it all right. I think it's gone all right so far, but don't be complacent. Keep going and refresh it. We've got to, you know, we've got to always look at new people to do the paper review. We've got to look at new kinds of guests. So I think there's no real one answer to that, but you kind of know it, I hope.
So final question, Rob, what are you most proud of?
I think I'm probably most proud of interviews, political interviews. I like them. I think when I... Do when I'm working with somebody like Emily Maitlis or Andrew Marr to construct a terrific interview, I'm very happy. The one I always remember, particularly with Jonathan Dimbleby, was during the 2005 election. Michael Howard, we had a show called Ask the Leaders, which was a show on ITV at 9 o'clock at night, or certainly in the evening. Michael, we pinned him down on an issue about immigration, and the next day that was kind of the dominant feature of the election campaign, was that particular exchange.
So you feel you've been an agent of history, is it?
Yeah,
you've shaped the debate.
You played some part in kind of moving the ball a bit in that particular situation and having an impact. So that's what you want to do. That's why you do it.
Rob, it's been a fantastic interview. I've learnt a ton. Thank you ever so much for your time.
Thank you. Cheers.
A Big Things Media production. This is